Welcome to Better Cast Saul, the officially unofficial podcast for Better Call Saul on AMC. I'm Jim.
I am Aaron.
And today we're here to talk about Season 4, Episode 1, titled Smoke, where there's smoke, there's a dead Chuck.
There's a podcast.
There's an asphyxiated Chuck. I feel like I made two jokes about dead Chuck.
Chuck roast.
At the beginning of this and the instant cast. I feel bad.
Hashtag Chuck roast.
Yeah.
That's the... What are the long-lasting effects of smoking a Charles McGill? Is it going to lead to mesothelioma? You know, the
mesothelioma. Yeah.
Thank you. Uh-huh. Thank you.
Yeah.
My mush mouth. It's one of the effects of Chuck inhalation.
You right.
Get tongue-tied and inability
dry
to
mouth.
Pronounce
that cotton mouth.
Yeah. Yeah. Can't pronounce complex medical terms.
What'd you think of this episode, Smoke?
I mean, it was a lot. It was a good reintroduction into the world of Better Call Saul. And I was a lot of times left cold by the pacing of last season, especially early on. And I think I didn't attempt to hide that borderline frustration. I felt like, you know, and I kind of started like when it became clear that the last like 15 minutes of the episode is going to be largely Mike just dicking around at a Madrigal. I'm like, oh boy. But I don't know. For some reason, I feel like there is a little bit, maybe it's because, you know, the Vince and Peter know exactly how much time they have left to spend on the show, but everything feels a little bit more crisper and focused. And it could be, I mean, I just to throw all my biases out there, it could be my awareness of knowing that they know it's the end is just altering my perception. So I'm not really trying to talk shit about the Villa Gang and the Ghouls because they are superior storytellers. I'm just saying that I felt like, you know, there was more of a point and more of an immediacy, and I feel like that you are really starting to see in real time the transformation of Jimmy into Saul. Mm-hmm. So I really enjoyed it as a primer and return back to this world. You?
I understand. Like, I shared many of the complaints of the pacing of last season, and a lot of it came down to those very extended, what I felt like were a little over the top scenes with Mike, where you know, he'd be dismantling his car for a good 10 minutes of the episode.
Right.
And did you need to make that 10 minutes? Could you have made it 5 and gotten the same effect? Maybe. And so some of those things I started to become impatient with. However, this episode I really enjoyed, and I don't know whether that's because this is not substantially different in pacing.
Right.
If I'm looking at it objectively from last season, what they did early on.
Right.
But I ended up enjoying it, I think, more than I did those previous ones. And maybe I've just been jonesing because it's been a long time since we've had Better Call Saul in the air.
You know,
it's a little bit longer than usual, 3 months or so. Maybe I'm just jonesing for more Saul. And so I'm willing to put up with it. And also, is a super entertaining excursion with Mike in this episode.
Yeah, just watching him, you know, it's one thing if he's just solo, just out in the desert, hanging up a shoe and, you know, doing, like, what the hell? Like, he's drilling holes in the hose for 5 minutes with the grandchild.
Or going piece by piece through his car.
Right.
Yeah.
Right, but when he's, like, you know, essentially running low-level social engineering scams on a building full of morons, it's pretty entertaining. And I do think that, like, if you, I know everyone, a lot of people don't like it when you compare it to the shows, but you can't help but compare it to Breaking Bad. And you think about, like, the first 3 seasons of Breaking Bad, how many people died, how many people went through profound physical and mental changes. You know, Hank was paralyzed for a certain amount of time. He had to deal with this trauma of seeing someone explode. And, like, I feel like we had our first big exclamation point with Chuck burning himself to death.
Yeah.
Like, that is a legit change to the landscape. That doesn't involve, like, just a minor setback to Jimmy's finances or a spat between him and Kim. Or, like, this is, like, a fundamental change in the show's dynamic going forward. And it's,
like,
it's exciting.
Yeah, it's like the Jane moment.
If I had to
compare it to something, from Breaking Bad. I think this is the moment that Jane died.
Right.
And how that's going to affect Jesse is profound. How this is going to affect Jimmy, I think, is profound. And it's not in the way we expect human to react.
Yeah, and think about how profoundly you're talking about the effect of Jane's death had on Jesse. Like, that manifested itself in many different ways.
Yeah.
Like, he was inconsolable. He was self-destructive. He was false tough guy macho. He was uncaring. It's all about the cash. Who gives a shit? Like, I think that there's a temptation to be like, oh, he's chuckling and whistling and feeding fish at the end of the episode. Saw, baby. I think because like this first scene that we get after the cold open, where we have this like lovely image of the embers from Chuck's fire landing, and you see, I think it's if I was a showrunner and I want to set a thesis for my season in 30 seconds, I would see, show these embers landing on all of Kim's case files, implying that the ripples of this act are going to consume her career, and then they land on, you know, their bed as Jimmy and Kim are sit there peacefully kind of spooning. Like that this is a fire that's going to spread and engulf both of them and really transform their lives in negative ways. Could just be a nice visual flourish, but I think they're trying to suggest, they're trying to lay out the thesis, and I think that that just prompts to be more exciting, even and more exciting than even getting Gus and Tuco and the cousins back into it, because like these are main characters that are going to be struggling with stuff. And I think that's really exciting. That's, you know, Walt would be talking about the chemical change, the oxidization, the transformation of matter from one state to another, and you're starting to see that. You're starting to see the chemistry really percolate on the show.
Yeah, absolutely. So enjoyable for me.
Hey, want to do some housekeeping and real quick, something for Better Call Saul fans, especially club members. If you didn't know, every Monday, as soon as we get done watching Better Call Saul, we take to the cameras and the microphones. We do a live instant reaction show called the Instant Talk Podcast. And part of that is we do our 15-20 minute instant take, but then we turn it over to our audience. The club members can click through on baldmove.com, the article. You'll see it. It'll post right when the show posts. You can click through a link and chat with us in real time. We'll consider your questions and your comments, and we'll talk about it. It's fun. We did it first last year or last season in Westworld, and we're bringing that technology to Better Call Saul. Also, don't forget, we do a podcast on HBO Sharp Objects. We got three more episodes of that left. It's a really intense, dark, psychological thriller along the lines of like a female Midwestern version of the True Detective Southern Gothic season one. Also this week we'll be doing first round Bald Movies Black Klansman, the latest Spike Lee joint. We're also 4 p.m. Eastern Standard Time on Tuesdays and Thursdays playing video games at twitch.tv/baldmove. If you want to see Jim and I hanging out playing video games and shoot the shit with us, feel free. That's open to everyone. We got a new Quit Your Pitching, dropping this Wednesday. So that's kind of fun. That'll be exciting. And finally, there is not even 24 hours left to get in on my book Kickstarter, book.baldmove.com. We just hit our first stretch goal, so you'll get double the book for your money. And if you want to see more about that, there's a book I wrote on the religions of Westeros with a religious scholar. It's been a lot of fun. I think you guys will enjoy the information. Check it out at book.baldmove.com if you want to get some of those exclusive Kickstarter rewards and help us stretch to those final goals.
Are we ready to talk about the episode?
Yes, please.
Okay. We start off with Gene being scraped off the floor of the Cinnabon, and he's taken to the hospital where the doctors clear him and send him home. But on his way out, he gets nervous when his fake ID information isn't going through. It turns out to be a typo, so he gets to leave in his taxi. But the man in the taxi is acting really weird. Gene gets spooked, and he decides to just get out in the snow on a random street. And he's breathing heavy. He looks like he's about to have another panic attack or whatever he had, and just fall over again.
Yeah, there's a couple things I liked about the scene. I liked how his face got shlacked with the Cinnabon jizz.
Yeah,
I thought that was like, that's got to be intentionally funny visual image. This man just his face is frosted.
And the spatula he's using to spread it or whatever,
yeah,
is just stuck to his face. It's good.
Yeah.
The medics have to remove it.
There's a lot of like interesting tension building devices they use here, obviously, with the computer keep kicking his information back with the nurse. That's the first thing. And how like just how baseline maddening that is when everyone's been in a situation where, like, we just had that coming back from Philadelphia. This like, we, because of traffic and all this stuff, we were like had 5 minutes to catch a train. And this train attendant who was trying to help us get this goddamn United special deal, this train is a fake airplane kind of bullshit ticket worked out. Just having the time of her life. Like, I felt like, you know, no sense of urgency. Just like, whatever. And like me and Jim are sweating bullets. Imagine that, except
as the train says boarding,
right?
Boarding.
Or last call for, and like, you know, and if we miss that train, then like we're not gonna. It's and like that's pretty low stakes compared to, oh shit, someone might make my fake ID and come and kill me.
Yeah.
It's great. This well meaning oblivious idiot trying to like small talk and put Jimmy at ease, which is making him. And then the whole stuff with the taxi cab driver. And I've thought about this more, and I think I read an interview with the Villigan where they talk about this Cottonwood Mall, because my ears perked up the second time I listened to him. Like, oh, this is interesting, because after he had this like panic attack / heart attack, he's still going to go back to the Cinnabon and probably close things up, take out the trash, do all the things he has to do as a manager, right?
Yeah.
But someone, I guess, had found out that like Cottonwood was the name of the fake mall that they had in Albuquerque?
Something like that, yeah.
But it's also the name of an actual mall in Nebraska, because I guess like Nebraska State tree is the Cottonwood. So like it works as kind of like, you know, the fact that like this guy, like the cab driver's from Albuquerque, let's say, that there's a little bit of like, do I recognize this guy from somewhere, from his stupid billboards and his late night TV Cottonwood Mall? Isn't that kind of a funny coincidence that they're both like, there's a lot of things that could be running through this taxi driver's mind. Do you think that?
Yeah, I don't think Cottonwood is the thing that does it there. It's the hanging ABQ of isotopes.
Well, that does it for Jimmy, but I'm saying what is the what's the
no? But
the
that
cab
tells
driver's
us
damage.
That tells us as an audience member that he might recognize the
right,
face a little bit.
Right.
Yeah, we don't need the Cottonwood to make that connection. And in fact, if you look at other scenes from Gene's other parts of Gene's scenes, you can see in the back there's a sign that says Cottonwood Mall. That's definitely where he works at the Cinnabon.
Yeah.
So, like, I don't think they're trying to make those kinds of connections. I think the ABQ isotopes thing does it all by itself.
Yeah, I mean, like, if the guy with the white man afro from the Keller and Keller commercials got into the back of my seat and I'm an Uber driver, he just has a handlebar mustache.
Aren't you?
I mean, I don't know that I actually say it, but I'd be like, man, that guy looks just like the Keller and Keller guy, the handlebar mustache. Like, I get it.
Yeah.
And, but there's also, like, you know, there's... I'm wondering if the start of season 5 will be Gene, you know, he's walking away from his taxi driver and the guy's like, hey, stop. And like there's this prolonged scene of him chasing Gene down. He's just trying to give him back like change or
his ID that fell out of his
ID or a receipt or like whatever. Like this illustrates the hell that Jimmy / Saul / Gene have found themselves in, that they've escaped, but their life like they're in a prison of their own making.
And that's the thing. I wonder, these scenes always make me wonder, what is going to happen with Gene? Because the doctor clears him. You know, he's in good health.
It's, right. Except for the not high blood pressure.
Yeah, which he doesn't see. It doesn't seem overly high.
Yeah,
you know, the doctor's not like, oh, dude, we need to get you on
your
diet.
Your arteries are about to explode like a worn out tire.
No. So he's in good health, but he's incredibly paranoid. And this is not a good way to live, like you said. It's hard to imagine, if you look at the way Breaking Bad ended for the main character, how this will end well for Saul.
Right.
I feel like Saul is either going to get caught or maybe he just lives out a sad existence, right?
Yeah.
Like an existence that Mike would be gleeful in would be hell for Saul.
Yeah.
So maybe he's just stuck inside drinking his what is it, lemon juice and
whatever.
I forget the name of that drink.
His New Mexico donkey.
Yes.
But I thought it was good. I did get briefly excited as the scene, you know, like kept on, I don't want to say drag on, but as it kept on extending, like I'm like, you know, man, are we going to get an actual you know, all Gene episode or something like that.
Right. It was a long one.
Yeah.
Which was nice. We also find out that Gene's last name is Takovic.
Takovic, yeah.
Which I don't think we knew up till this point.
Mm-mm. That's not an Irish name.
No, he's gone the other direction with
some
it.
Some kind
I guess.
Of Slavic. Slavic, I'm guessing.
Yeah. So that was good info. Then Jimmy wakes up. This is present day, or whatever the fuck present day qualifies.
Right.
The main chunk of the timeline of this show.
Two,
yeah.
I don't know.
He's with Kim. How about that? In bed. He wakes up. He begins his job hunt, and then Hanlon calls to tell him what happened to Chuck. Jimmy rushes over to see the burned house, and after talking with the fire chief, Kim tells Chuck, oh, he didn't suffer. Jimmy's like, yeah, they'll always say that. Yeah, they'll never come up to you and say, oh, yeah, he had a real bad there at the end.
You know, the Salem witch trials where they burn people alive screaming. It's kind of like that.
The fire didn't get him. The smoke got him. But it's more painful, actually, than the fire itself.
Yeah. And I guess that's like, literally true that you will more often die from the actual asphyxiation than being burnt to death. But that doesn't mean that you won't fully experience burning to death for 60 to 90 seconds before it happens.
Yeah.
And just with the proximity of Chuck to the source of the fire, it seems like it was a pretty bad way to go.
Yeah, he probably got a little of both.
But also a way that it's almost like a Tibetan monk protesting occupation. Like, he had to sit there in the fire and will himself to remain where he was, because at any time he could have gotten up and left, at least in the initial stages of it. So
I mean, Howard's not wrong when he says that Chuck is strong.
Right.
It's just that Chuck focuses his strength in weird ways sometimes.
Yeah, graduating high school at 14, burning alive.
Yep.
It's not good.
And so Jimmy takes notice that all of Chuck's electrical equipment is in the backyard, leading him to believe that he had another EHS attack before he died and wondered what could have caused it.
Really like the music here, as we see dissolve to Jimmy after he sees the coroner wagon pulling away, that he's sitting there on the park bench looking at that skeleton of the house, and the mournful horns are playing. Really like that. I really like that from this point in the episode until the very end, Jimmy is in a profound depression, which I don't think we've seen him at this state. Like, he's definitely had pity parties. He's definitely felt put upon and shit on. He's definitely felt abused by the unwashed assholes of the world. But, like, this kind of, like, long-lasting, inescapable funk, it's interesting just to note how and why he gets out of it by the end of the episode. Did you happen to look at any of the things that he was circling on the want ads?
The want ads, yeah. I looked at a few. Couple sales jobs for, like, cell phones and copiers. Right. It's a computer services job. There's a kid's store and playhouse receptionist.
Yeah, seems like a poor fit for him.
Yeah, he's kind of smiling when he's circling that one, like, oh, this will be a chuckle.
That'll be good to get fired from in about 3 weeks after I say the wrong thing to the wrong mother.
Right.
I also something I got from the Heisenberg Chronicles that our buddy Shane runs is one of the ads right next to the ad that he circled was for the laser base laser tag facility.
Nice.
That later becomes a potential money laundering a scheme put forward by Saul that, of course, Skylar White nixes in favor for the A1 car wash. But yeah, I thought that was a nice little touch. You know, they didn't have to do that.
Yeah,
it seems like they look for ways to make the universe cooler and more have that self-referential integrity.
Yeah, I didn't even notice that because I was looking at the circled ones.
Sure, right.
So it's just an extra little Easter egg there.
Exactly. And I thought to him, the whole time he's reading the paper, I was very tense because I'm thinking, you know, name partner of like the biggest law firm in the city, maybe the state. It's like a national reach, and he burns alive in his own kind of mansion, and maybe that would make the front page of the local, or like. And every time he turned the page, I kept on expecting him to hit, and then you find, you know, it's just a little interesting way to increase the tension throughout the episode.
And we also see Jimmy staring at the electrical equipment outside of Chuck's house, just very similar to how Chuck did in the past when he was suffering from his EHS. You don't think that Jimmy's going to go suffer from a bout of EHS himself, do you?
Like, I
a
hope
sympathetic
not. I hope not.
Illness here?
I mean, I hope not, because that would make him, you know, have a, like, I don't know. I was about to say that'd make him mental. It'd make him have a mental illness, and then it's, you start getting into the unreliable narration and all. Like, I don't enjoy that, because like that's all about sharp objects, right? Mm-hmm. Westworld plays with that. Leftovers plays with that. But like, I kind of want to be inside a POV character. That'd just be like a zig for this show, I think.
Yeah, the show doesn't do that.
Right. And I don't know. Is that a thing? Like, it's one thing if you just convince yourself because of some, you know, like a bunch of coincidence happen. You get on the internet and the internet says, oh, yeah, you're not crazy. You got EMS, electromagnetic sensitivity. But like, Jimmy has seen it from the other's perspective, where like he's tested him. He's seen it. It's fake. Like, if Can you convince yourself something's real after you've convinced yourself it's fake? I mean, just from a real, like a realism thing. Is that something that people do?
Probably. Huh. I don't know. I mean, they're probably like stories of religious deconversion and reconversion.
Yeah, like I've heard of like atheists becoming Christians, and I've heard of Christians becoming atheists, but I never heard of a Christian that becomes an atheist that then becomes a Christian again.
Yeah.
Like that seems like...
I imagine it happens.
Yeah, maybe. Oh, I mean, in the history of the universe, it's the number of times it's happened is not zero for sure.
Absolutely.
But would it be compelling on Better Call Saul? I don't know. I don't
yeah,
think so.
Yeah, I don't think they're going that direction. But it was interesting to see that. He's definitely, in my mind, like, yes, he's in this deep depression that you're talking about throughout this episode, but he's also thinking. Mm. He's thinking very deeply about what could have caused this. And it's all set up in this scene when he goes, all the electrical equipment is out there. He had another attack. What caused it?
Right, because
he's racking his brain.
And I think the
thing was it my fault? Was it Chuck's fault? Was it Howard's fault? Kim's fault? What was it?
And the thing I think that both Howard and Jimmy don't realize is how much of Chuck's recovery was spite.
yeah, like, absolutely.
He is faking it to put the screws to Jimmy, to put the screws to the law firm, and once those legs...
put the screws to the insurance company, everything.
Once those legs of spite were kicked out from underneath him, then he just, you know, he's made a fool of himself in front of his colleagues and peers, in front of his ex-wife, who he really cared about, and, you know... Like, I think burning himself was spite, because he knew exactly, like, if you look on his face as he's kicking that lantern, that's the thing of, like, you know, it's like, oh, I'm going to, it's like Ralphie in A Christmas Story. Like, I'm going to show them, I'm going to go blind from soap consumption, and then they'll be sorry. It's you know, right. I think that's, yeah, pretty dark, but I think that's the place Chuck was in.
Mm-hmm. All right, we move on to Mike's last day as the gatekeeper at the parking lot. It's over. He volunteers to take care of Kaylee since he can make his own hours now. And when he gets home, he's pleased to see that he has a large check from Madrigal waiting for him. However, he gets antsy and decides to find the nearest Madrigal facility. We don't know what for yet, but we find out soon enough. I love this moment where they make him give the windbreaker back.
Right.
And Mike doesn't put up a stink. Mike gets it. You know, it's like, this is a slap in my face. Mm-hmm. I'm done with this job. I don't care. Of course, this guy's so petty that he wants his stupid windbreaker back.
Right.
Fine. Take it. I don't care.
Right. He's going to go to Sam's Club and buy a knockoff North Face that he's going to wear the rest of the episode. Like, that's kind of like, you know, Mike's uniform anyway. So you got to get rid of the security windbreaker. Mm-hmm. But yeah, also, man, if your boss wants you to get, you know, if you're not a manager and your boss wants you to recover company property from another employee on their last day, they need to come down to the fucking booth and do it.
Yeah, that's like, a manager's job.
That's what the guy should have been like, oh, am I a manager now? I need manager pay, because if I'm not getting manager pay, then I'm not going to do manager jobs.
Uh-huh.
Like, not that Mike would, like, bust his face in for it, but, like, come on. That's what you pay HR folks and management types to do. That's the uncomfortable human interactions that largely justify their pay, right?
Yeah.
So fuck that guy.
I also think Mike probably knows that having that jacket out there might be some kind of minor security risk.
Oh, yeah, sure.
Like, if you can, it makes it much easier to impersonate a parking lot attendant.
Yep. And it's a threat. Also, for him, so it's a like, threat that people can pull if they just see him on the street. It's something that's, you know, makes him memorable. Oh, he had that jacket from that security company on.
Yeah.
So it makes sense. I'm just saying it's shitty management, which there's no shortage of in this world.
The other thing I love is the scene where he's volunteering to take care of Kaylee. They repurpose the hose, and they overtly mention this. I noticed it like almost immediately. It starts on the shot of the hose with the water spraying, and I was like, oh, that must be the same hose.
Mm-hmm.
But then what's her face?
Right.
I can't remember
Stacey.
Her name. Stacey just flat out says, oh, is that the hose that you guys made?
Yeah, it's interesting that he's just like, he's a very waste not want not kind of guy. Mm-hmm. Like, I'm going to go and deconvert this from a stop strip into a soaker hose.
Yeah.
Madrigal pay, $10,000 in Albuquerque, New Mexico, 10 to 15 years ago, after taxes.
Yeah.
Guy like Mike lived pretty high on the hog. Now, the whole, like, because I was fuzzy on, like, what all this, like, this is an effort to launder the money that he stole from Hector to give back to that one civilian's widow that got caught up in the deal gone wrong and shot and left out in the desert. So
yeah, Mike's paying himself here. Madrigal's not giving him a dime.
Right.
He's actually giving them money.
Right. So I think we had a lot of open questions about what Mike's trying to do at the end of the episode. I thought maybe we'd entertain right now. Mm-hmm. Why is let's talk about some potential reasons why Mike decides to put on the hard hat and the reflective vest and go give Madrigal a security enema.
One, he feels it's his duty because he's making a bunch of his own money.
Right.
That seems weird because they're not really paying him.
Maybe he wants to make more money too because, like, you know, I want to be able, like, I want to help this person out, but I also want to help myself and Kaylee and Stacy out too. Mm-hmm. There's also one that I thought of that, like I said, he wants to see what dirt is underneath Gus's finger. But more than that, he wants to see how careful an operation. Mm-hmm. Because if they're running their operation sloppy, it's better chances for them to get an IRS audit, better chances for them to get into law enforcement trouble. So he's trying to, like, seal these leaks for his own benefit.
Yeah.
So he's justifying, like, you know, his actual role and maybe angling for a raise or a bigger part of the organization. He's trying to make sure that everything is, like, on the up and up as far as their security practices. Is there any other? He's bored?
I mean, I think a little bit of it, yeah. Maybe he's bored.
He wants to flex those skills?
Yeah. I do think he wouldn't do what he does unless he enjoyed it at least a little bit.
Right, right.
It's cool, though, to see that this is kind of the beginning of what we know turns into a semi-adversarial relationship with Lydia.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it's not all roses between them when he shows up to her house to kill her, right?
Yeah, and it says, trust me, this woman deserves death as much as any man. Like, yeah. They have a history.
Uh-huh.
They have a history.
So this is kind of cool because you could see, like, her getting angry about this person just coming in and trying to run the operation,
right.
Maybe. Mike doing it for essentially the right reasons, to protect himself, protect Kaylee, protect mm-hmm. everyone involved.
Right.
And Lydia maybe resenting that.
Well, and there's also, like, you know, this is Mike's philosophy. Like, there's all kinds of criminals. There's all kinds of, you know, quote-unquote good people. You can be a good person on the wrong side of law. You can be a bad person on the right side of law. I think he thinks that Lydia's a bad person on the bad side of the law.
Yeah.
Also, in a little minor note, because it's funny that we're debating about the isotopes, and, like, I thought that they're a minor league team, but, like, Mike is actually watching an isotopes game while he's pouring over his pay stub. So
nice.
Is right there in the episode.
Yeah. All right. Then we move on to Hamlin calling Jimmy to run Chuck's obituary by him. It's extremely long winded with all of his various awards and achievements. And halfway through, Jimmy puts the phone down. Kim picks it up and she approves the obituary. And then she tries to soothe Jimmy with some shots of fancy booze, but only succeeds in drinking herself to sleep while Jimmy stays up all night thinking. I noticed that Hamlin doesn't really need to look at notes for this obituary. He
I noticed that too.
Has this memorized.
Right.
He's gone over it many, many times.
Right, right.
And it's very late at night. You can see that he's been in the office for a long time. This strikes me as so Hamlin.
Yeah, no.
He's almost giving a speech, right? It's weird.
Yeah, and I think that's... I was trying to think, like, what exactly causes Jimmy to disconnect from the process? Is it the fact that halfway through, it turns into an advert for HHM. Is it the fact that the realization that he, as important of a role that he's played in his brother's life the last few years, like helping him with his EMS and all that, and their shared family history, that he is but a minor footnote. Mm. You know, he is just the answer. Now, I don't think that's unreasonable because, like, most obituaries are like that. It's more about the person who died and then who survived them than it is about, oh, also this person's a successful lawyer. Or is it just that he's in a fog and he doesn't care? Like,
exactly.
Him and Chuck were done.
Yeah.
And it's like, what a fucked up situation that, like, you have a problematic relationship with a friend or a colleague or whatever, and you're like, you know what? Fuck you, fuck me, I'm out of here. And they die the next day.
Yeah, no, it's rough.
Like, how do you, like,
It's especially rough on Hamlin.
Yeah.
He takes it the hardest.
Yeah.
But yeah, I mean, Jimmy, I think you're right. I think he doesn't care in this moment. And that's very Jimmy. That Jimmy is looking at how this affects him in a weird way, right? Yeah. Like, he's trying to figure out if he caused the problem that led to Chuck's death.
And there's a version of this that could have brought him and Howard closer together, because they both realized that, like, if Chuck was just not a giant asshole, none of this would happen. Because Howard did not want to force Chuck out. No. Howard wanted Chuck to realize the damage he's doing to the firm, mm-hmm. and, like, to be reasonable about things. And he just were in same way with Jimmy. Like, Jimmy just wanted him to stop being a bully and stop interfering with my life, stop interfering by extension my girlfriend's life. Yeah. Show like acknowledge that I have worth as a person, that I'm not the same kid that I grew up with, maybe that you've had me wrong your whole life. Mm-hmm. But instead, it looks like it's going to be a wedge that drives him even further apart.
Yeah. It seems like it.
Yeah.
Or maybe Howard and Kim are going to team up to figure out what the fuck is wrong with Jimmy.
Yeah, I don't know.
Because I can't wait until we get to the end scene, because I really want to talk about that. But
right. Oh.
You might have noticed in this scene
that
Kim pulls out a bottle of booze mm-hmm. that we've seen before many times.
Oh, yes.
It's almost becoming too much of a thing in this show, because it's their go-to for booze,
right.
High-end booze. It's Zafiro Añejo.
Uh-huh.
It's a thing that, if you're familiar with Breaking Bad, and God, you should be by now, the thing that kills Don Eladio, it's the booze that they're drinking when they con.
They're taking that one guy for a ride.
Is it Ken?
Is it
I think
Ken
it's
wins?
Ken
it
wins.
Might be Ken wins.
I think it's that time.
That might be because Ken wins the guy. Doesn't they fuck him like over a coin in the bar? Because there's a couple of times where Jim and Kimmy are running a scam on
right.
dudes, and this is one of those.
It was either that guy or the guy that Kim meets in the bar, and I can't remember which.
Shots.
Yeah.
How much? Do you remember when Philly we like ask as a joke how much that
$2.50 for the Louis XIII shot?
Shot of Louis the what?
Louis XIII.
$250.
Yeah.
Holy
it's
God!
Very high in brandy, I think.
Cognac.
Yeah.
I'm not sure.
Super high end.
Too rich for my blood, by far.
Absolutely.
But yeah, no. I also like in all because like I listened to I listened to his obituary, and I was looking up things like Georgetown's legal ranking, and it's like 14th in the U.S. for school, so it's a pretty prestigious
14th. I would have thought higher.
I know, me too. I thought that'd be top 10.
Yeah,
but there's a lot of competition. You know, you mm-hmm. got NYU and
Chicago's
Princeton
got a really good law
Harvard
school,
and all like you. So I think that what was interesting out of all the stuff was that, and I didn't know this before, that he got a start in criminal law. It's interesting that his brother was like, I'm sure a squeaky clean, straight edge, like upright criminal lawyer, and that his brother becomes a criminal lawyer.
Hmm.
Like it's an interesting duality for the two brothers, that he started in criminal law. So did Jimmy. Jimmy then goes on elder care and all this other stuff, and he ends up in italicized criminal law.
Right. So then we move on to Hector being carted off in an ambulance. This picks up right where we left them last season.
Mm-hmm.
Nacho tries to ditch the fake pills that he swapped, but he's interrupted when Gus gets a phone call from Juan Bolsa requesting to see Nacho. Nacho's nervous, but when they meet, Juan simply wants to make sure that Hector's operation continues smoothly with him out of the picture. And after the meeting, Gus cautions Juan that the DEA may come sniffing around if war breaks out, which he thinks is inevitable.
I love that. The whole, it's like Yoda with the dark side speech. It's that someone's going to move against the Salamancas, perhaps the Frings, which will bring war and chaos. And
this is a beautiful thing.
They
pronounce
Dea.
They don't even do the DEA. Uh-huh. They just Dea. Okay.
Uh-huh. I also like how they pronounce chaos as cows.
Yeah.
Now, I don't know what you're. I didn't mean to cut you off, but like with the La Dea coming,
mm-hmm.
There's no way we're getting Hank. I would not be surprised to see.
I don't
ASAC,
think we can get Hank. No.
I would not be surprised to see ASAC Merkert. Pop up.
Yeah.
Like I kind of want to see like their fishing trip.
Uh huh.
Like some of the fundraise. Like that would be kind of a fun little bit of fan service.
Absolutely.
But
this is the funny thing, because like, we know that the DEA eventually gets involved, and we've seen the takedown of Juan Bolsa, and we've seen that Gus is kind of the cause of it, right?
Mm-hmm.
That Gus has been gunning for him. So this is when he warns him that the DEA is coming. It's because we know he's gonna lead them right to Wong.
Of course, of course.
And it's actually, I'm super curious to see how that happens. And I guess it's all of Better Call Saul, right? Like,
yeah.
We know what's gonna happen. Just how does it happen?
Yeah, it's interesting because like I was wondering if Nacho, you know, the way they're playing up this drugs and he's trying to like, you know, ditch the pills, but he can't. Mm-hmm. It seems like that from the Salamanca side, he is not under any kind of suspicion at all.
Yeah.
But on the Fring side of the equation, he's under a lot of suspicion. What will how will Gus twist Nacho for his best use?
That's the thing. We follow Nacho to the bridge where he throws the pills off, and Victor has also followed him, mm-hmm. and he spies him doing it. He has a tracker on his car. I think, obviously, Gus was suspicious of Nacho. Now he knows for sure that he was involved.
Yeah.
I will say I don't think this is necessarily a bad thing for Nacho. I think Gus is a reasonable person.
And they're working at identical purposes. They both want the Salamancas to not be ran by lunatics.
And I think Gus would recognize how important Nacho's family is and how wrong what Hector was trying to do is.
He would pay lip service to it anyway.
Yeah, my point is I don't think he's going to kill Nacho.
No,
dad. I think, honestly, he's probably going to, like, adopt Nacho. He's going to turn him to the...
But it's dangerous because they have to... They'll have to keep that, like...
They will, yeah.
You know, that can't be, like, obviously them working together because then the territory would not really be Salamanca territory.
Now I could see Gus maybe using Nacho, adopting Nacho, and then causing Nacho to be the lead back to Juan Bolsa through the DEA and, like...
Right.
Maybe taking him down that way.
What if we'll see any of the other drug dealers, like when Walt, you know, had his say my name moment in the desert, he's meeting with those goons. Maybe some of the Neo, like I wonder if we'll see like that or the Neo Nazis kind of prowling around and Nacho has to like put the smackdown on him.
Yeah.
Because you're right. There is a perceived power vacuum now that Tuco's in prison and Hector's in the hospital and he ain't getting out anytime soon. So I'm very interested to see how we might have this low intensity drug war that Mike gets embroiled in doing cool Mike stuff.
Speaking of cool Mike stuff, this is where the episode gets weird for a second, and I go, "What are they showing me, and why do I care?" So there's a random guy who fixes his son's bike, and he's late for work because his car won't start. Then we see that he actually works for Madrigal, and Mike has stolen his badge to do an impromptu security audit. And the manager isn't happy when he points out all the flaws, but Mike tells him, take it up with Lydia.
Right.
I know people.
Mm-hmm. Reads the guy the Riot Act.
Here's the only pacing complaint I have with this episode is I don't know why this guy has to fix his kid's bike to get to the meat of what we want. Is it because they're trying to show, all the people who work for Madrigal aren't bad? It's just Lydia.
I think that, and like Alan Sepinwall had a line in his review that made the point that by showing this guy as a careful, sober, responsible, meticulous person, it elevates Mike in our eyes because Mike just doesn't take advantage of sloppy, careless people. Mike is just that much more anal and prepared and careful than that guy is.
Right.
So also, I just kind of dig it. Like, I wouldn't want to see 5 minutes of this guy fixing the kid's bike, but like, this made him memorable. So then when you see Mike pull up to this guy in a temporary ID, it makes that scene better by giving this other scene more time to breathe, I think.
Okay.
But I can see your point too.
I do love the fact that he didn't even bother to modify the badge or anything. He didn't put his own picture on it.
Yeah, he's just
picture of a...
And I thought, like, this is kind of a plot hole, but then he throws it in the guy's face. Like, I've got a obviously bogus badge. No one ever... And he starts off like he just goes and he grabs a coffee mug, pours himself some coffee, goes through the
Tyson versus or the
donuts,
Tyson, the Lee versus Ollie.
Yeah, injects himself in the bait. That's another thing, another motivation I saw on Reddit that I don't think we've talked about. That like Mike starts thinking, I'm a security consultant. What if someone starts poking around and trying to like? He's going and making a big splash. So if anyone ever questions his role as a security consultant, multiple people be like, oh, yeah, we know that guy. He's a fucking asshole. He came and reamed us all out, said that Ali would kick Bruce Lee's ass, stole our donuts, told Tammy to reach for the stars. got her middle management fired, and then
I love that he actually signs the guy's name. Like, that's so kind of him, right? Because if Tina looks at that and she's like, where the fuck is Barry's name?
Where the fuck?
Barry didn't sign my card. That motherfucker. No.
Barry.
So he actually like helps the guy out.
It was pretty cool. And just like he's going through the pit, you know, he's doing a lot of stuff that you can see. One of the reasons that Gus was so hard to track down is that someone like Mike sweated those details. You can't be reusing manifest numbers. You can't be throwing away shipping invoices. You can't be letting people run around without. But man, social engineering is a bitch.
To try and protect
against. Maybe the CIA, FBI, NSA, paramilitary contractors, but I'm telling you, hospitals, police departments, data centers, it's terrible. It's terrible because we haven't figured out a way to secure the human mind from peer pressure and the desire to cooperate and get along and not be hassled. Like, it's incredibly hard to toughen the target that is the human brain.
Sure.
And it's just... like it's disgustingly easy. It's one thing that was always gave. Okay, see, I used to get in, have to do these, you know, credit card security audits, and it was a bitch. Like every single, like, it is always a task to get to 1,500 plus location company that I work for to pass the penetration aspect of the test, because it's just painfully easy to get, in this case, convenience store cashiers to go along with anyone with that had a clipboard and pretended to have some authority, because boy, they don't want to get they don't want to cause this person trouble and get smacked back. So
My favorite part of this probably is when he stops to tell the guy to put lifting belts on his team.
Right.
That's not even a security thing.
Right.
He's just
rules
like,
are rules. Yeah.
Yeah. That was awesome. So we go over to the funeral for Chuck, and Jimmy is barraged by a never ending stream of condolences and handshakes. Afterward, he and Kim find Howard waiting on their steps, and Howard believes Chuck's death was not an accident. He believes actually that he might have caused it. And Jimmy tells him it's his cross to bear, and he begins whistling and preparing coffee and feeding his fish like he doesn't have a care in the world.
Wow. I did not notice this, but someone more astute than I on Reddit pointed out that the music they played during Chuck's funeral was the piece he was practicing at the beginning of the season 2, episode 2, which we found out was written. It's a duet for cello and piano, and his wife, I think, is a cellist.
She's a concert violinist.
Violinist, that's right. And that was something written by her, apparently.
Right.
So, like, that was an extra little, if you're paying attention, unlike me, kind of a bit of a gut punch. I also really liked how they mixed in lawyers that we knew well, like Ed Begley Jr.'s very frustrated partner of Jimmy last season, the kind of slime ball the guy that was representing the well, it wasn't Mesa Verde, that's the bank, it was whatever Sundowners retirement complex or whatever. These guys that, like, you know, we kind of know, and a bunch of people we don't, but you know, it really got the idea that, like, Jimmy's just having to endure all these people and he's so distracted. And then, man, Jimmy, so someone pointed out that this was a result of Jimmy taking Chuck's words to heart last year about, like, you know what? I don't even mind that you're a shit human being, but why all of the I'm sorry and the histrionics and the, like, emotional upheaval? Just admit that you're a bad person that hurts and uses people and go on with your life. I don't feel like it fits the scene. It really does feel like Jimmy got let off the hook. He's all too happy to let Howard take all of the blame, and that weight has physically been lifted from him.
Yeah, I think there are... So I spent a lot of time thinking about this scene in particular.
Yeah.
It didn't have much time, but I used it focused here. Where I eventually come down on it is this scene is designed for us to be Kim in that final moment. That eyebrow raise at the end says it all. And that's what we as an audience are thinking. What the fuck?
Yeah.
Jimmy.
Yeah.
It's meant to tease more than anything. It's not meant to really understand yet. This is the exclamation that says this is what we're exploring through the rest of the season.
Right.
But I do think there are several possible things that could be going through Jimmy's head. Like you said, he could feel like this is his opportunity to jettison Chuck guilt-free, right? Mm-hmm. He's dead. He doesn't have to take care of him anymore.
Right.
Chuck's not there to guilt him if he does things that are wrong.
Right.
Howard's taking the blame for his death. These are all things that let Jimmy off the hook.
Yeah.
And maybe that's enough to just Jimmy changes, you know? I don't know. I don't see it as that simple, as that black and white, that easy for him.
And even if he, even if he makes that as a snap emotional decision to like, okay, well, I don't have to worry about it. I'll let, you know, like, even if, I don't think Jimmy believes that he's completely blameless, but if this Howard situation, obviously a contributing factor, he's not the only one to blame. And hey, how, that's amazing for him. Mm-hmm. But whether you decide to act like that, whether you can get away with that for long, like, you know, in the long hours of the night when he is doing his job search, when he is, you know, taking long drives to get to his commute or whatever, or commutes to get to his work, like, those are the things, like, are these things going to come back to haunt him?
Right.
Because it's all well and good to be like, oh yeah, I'm just going to emotionally rinse my hand of this situation, but can you actually do it?
Yeah.
Is it going to be a telltale heart situation? Is it going to be like Lady Macbeth with the blood on her hands? Like, some of this stuff has a way of coming back to bite you in the end.
Yeah, and I really think Jimmy here is grasping the first life raft that's thrown to him. Mm-hmm. In the sense that there are a lot of fingers pointing at Jimmy as the cause for Chuck's death. The insurance bullshit that he did, right? Where he got Chuck's insurance raised by leaking the fact that he was sick.
Right.
There's...
Because if it's Howard's fault, it's actually the initial thing was Jimmy...
Right, but Chuck is absolving him of that. Like, he's taking all the fingers that Jimmy has been pointing at himself, questioning, uh-huh, was this the thing? Was, uh-huh, this the thing that caused it? And Jimmy is... Or Chuck is giving him... Sorry. Howard is giving him the opportunity to say, this is the thing. This is the life raft that's being thrown to him so he can absolve himself of all this guilt.
Right.
And so he's grasping that desperately. I don't think he'll be able to hang on to it. Yeah. I think it's going to come back perhaps worse than it would have been if he had just sat down and said, yes, I have a hand in this.
Is there a darker implication here that maybe Jimmy is somehow satisfied that his machination to bring down Chuck caused him to kill himself?
Jesus, maybe?
Like once he realized how the whole thing went. Because, like, the thing, like, the realization that Chuck was only too happy to break him legally.
Yeah.
Like, you know, take everything
and then tell him
so
that he never cared for him.
And that, pull that whole, like, anything as brutal as we've seen Adora do on sharp objects.
Right.
Well, that might be stretching a little bit. But still, like, you know, like, I'm your brother and I never loved you, mm-hmm, is a shitty thing to hear. Shitty thing to say.
Absolutely. Yeah.
So.
I do think there are some going concerns now, other than how is Jimmy going to handle
this? The metaphorical embers blowing over Jimmy and Kim's life?
As long as they don't hit that stack of, I don't know, $8,100 bills that Chuck must be sitting on.
Sure.
More than that. $80,100 bills. Because he's got this $8 million check from Howard that just went to his account. Where does Chuck's money go? Does Chuck's money go to Jimmy?
That's one of the things I was...
Does it go to Rebecca?
What does his estate look like?
Yeah.
Did he have time to cut Jimmy out of his will? Was Jimmy ever in his will?
Is there going to be some battle over it? Because I could see a situation where Howard gets the money.
Yeah.
Because it was part of, you know, his estate and,
right,
and the company and all that.
Sure.
It's probably legally entangled. Howard could get that money and then Jimmy could do something nefarious to take
it
from him.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And or vice versa. Howard could try to, like, you know, weasel out of the settlement because, you know, how many people knew about it? Where was the paperwork?
Right.
Like, is there going to be some crossing of legal lines in that department just to kind of... Because now they don't have his name. Mm. There's already some kind of, like, controversy swirling around the firm. Now it's his Hamlin and his empty suit.
Right.
Like, I don't know that HH&M is going to have a really rosy next 10 years. And, you know, Howard might start realizing that, like, hey, we got to keep a hold of this cash.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know, like, legally.
And did he even cash that check? I feel like when he got the check, he was pissed off and didn't want anything to do with it.
I don't know.
I can't quite remember.
Because, yeah, if, like, he didn't cash a check and,
Yeah, it's nothing official.
And the, you know, settlement got burnt up in the house, and the only other copy of this confidential agreement is the HH&M. Well, what if that just, like, walks out the door and gets set on fire? I mean, I know there's document retention systems that specifically to keep this from happening, but, you know, I don't know if Billigan knows that.
I'm just thinking, like, Jimmy...
Also, I don't know if those were implemented in 2007 or when this was taken, because that was, like, about... wherever that was all the rage, like, you know, digitizing your documents and controlling them and all that.
Yeah. How much control does Howard have over that stuff as essentially the sole proprietor now?
Right.
I don't know. I think it would be interesting if Jimmy got the money and had to start laundering it. And that's kind of what reconnected him with Mike and Nacho and Gus, because we know that he has I don't know if intimate is the right word, but a closer relationship with Mike in Breaking Bad than he does right now.
Sure.
So there's going to be more shenanigans with them. But that's the end of the episode.
Yep. Before we get to feedback, some real ball buster came by the studio today. Last name, Mantrout something.
Had a real weird head.
Miguel Mantrout. And he had this like weird bruised peach of a head. And he's just ranting and raving about auditing our club memberships. And it turns out that you are not a member. And we can tell because if you're a member, you'd be taking advantage of our ad-free feeds and you wouldn't be listening to us harangue you about... Look rules are rules. You got to wear lift belts. You can't reuse manifests. And if you want Bald Move to continue covering the shows you love, you got to support us with the club.
And it's not the support. I just don't want that guy to come back.
No, right. Yeah.
I don't want to see him.
Wouldn't
again.
Shut up about Muhammad Ali. It's just it was a very uncomfortable experience. He's got that dead mackerel gaze that he fixed to you. I just want the problem to go away. You can help us out by going to club.baldmove.com. Not only do you get the ad-free feeds, not only do you get the audio or video versions of most of our podcasts and a bunch of other bonus content and VIP forums, you get this Mantrout off of our back. please help us out, club.baldmove.com. I have feedback.
All right, let's do that.
If you would like to send feedback, you can do so at bettercastsaul@baldmove.com, and you can also join our weekly discussion on our forums, forums.baldmove.com. There's always an episode thread in the Better Call or the Better Cast Saul subforum. First up, Stephanie R. In listening to your preview, there was some discussion about how Saul can show up in New Mexico when he is this figure that has been all over the place on television with his brother dying in a fire, etc. It got me to thinking, what do we really know about what was happening in Saul's life during Breaking Bad? We saw Saul when he was doing lawyer stuff with Walt, Jesse, etc. Did we ever see Saul at home? Did we ever really see much of the other stuff going on in his office? Couldn't there be some overlap between the things we see in Better Call Saul and the timeline of Breaking Bad that just wasn't shown because it wasn't relevant to the story? I don't think yet, but these next two seasons do open up the possibility that those stories might start to overlap. Mm-hmm. Because even when he was in Thick with Walt and Jesse, he still had a lobby full of dudes in neck braces and slings, and there was he was cranking through a lot of low-level, you know, legal stuff, drunk driving stuff, personal injury stuff, ambulance chasing stuff. So certainly he wasn't his only client. Stephanie says, I got to thinking about this because I'm a lawyer as well. This show and lawyers, man. I think 97% of all feedback is from lawyers on the show. And there is an issue a lot of lawyers have where clients think they're the only client you have and expect immediate response to problems, even though, like any other job, your tasks need to be managed. That's a client thing. Mm-hmm. Not a legal thing, because programmer, as a web developer, they paid you money and you should be the most important thing to them. Mm-hmm. Or they should be the most important thing to you, rather. Similarly, we have fallen into the trap that Walt and Jesse we assume are Saul's only clients. My point is, other stuff is going on in his life, and couldn't there be some sort of fallout going on even while he's doing his work with Walt and Jesse? Wouldn't it be interesting to see that story play out, but from Jimmy Saul's perspective, while Walt and Jesse are doing their thing? Totally. I would be very happy if the last season of this, you saw like Walt and Jesse in the waiting room, but you never actually got into that because we've seen that. You just see how much more stress this crazy ass, cancer stricken high school chemistry teacher is inflicting on quote unquote poor Saul.
I want to see the aftermath when Walt breaks the window, the door.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. I want to see how Saul reacts to that.
For sure. That would be funny. Or just like his perspective of getting drug out into the desert.
Uh-huh.
You know, like the morning after if that happens. But it's not his first rodeo. We saw in the first pilot episode that Tuco, like, and he's way scarier than Walt and Jesse in a ski mask.
Yeah.
So. Matthew C. I want to talk about guilt. Jimmy's guilt and shame over Chuck's death. Even before Hamlin reveals that Chuck was pushed over the edge via the insurance fuckover, Jimmy must feel at least slightly responsible for his brother's death. This is just normal human emotional operations post-tragedy. You question who's responsible, if it could have been prevented, and crucially, if you could have done something differently. And Jimmy, yes, all throughout his relationship with Chuck, could certainly have done things better. So the first feeling Jimmy has is the natural, and even more acute, considering their contentious relationship, sense of responsibility, self-loathing, and guilt. The second feeling tearing at Jimmy in these quiet moments, and that which ultimately wins the day when Hamlin reveals the insurance fuckover, is, more or less, spite. Jimmy and Chuck have been in a grudge match for what appears to be their entirety of their lives, and the insurance salvo from Jimmy was countered with a suicide. Perhaps much like Bruce Lee might counter Ali's jab with a leg sweep.
That's what I was thinking. The very strong Chuck, right, is the Ali in this situation.
Yeah,
the very
slippery
guy would be Bruce Lee, therefore Jimmy.
Look at Jimmy's fist, though. It's just a little McGill fist. How could he possibly punch Chuck in the face?
Sweep the leg.
Sweep the leg.
Sweep the leg, Jimmy.
Regardless, Jimmy hears that his last jab hit Chuck where it hurts, and he won't let the counter take him down. Fuck Chuck, killing himself as revenge, being a baby, trying to make everyone feel bad for him, etc. Jimmy won't have it, and he's happy to take out the Chuck-induced anger on Hamlin. Hamlin anger is hanger. Yeah, I mean, that's what I was thinking. Like, I know suicide's a touchy subject, and certainly for the people that are living with suicidal ideation, you want them to get help. But I've had suicide touch my life, and there's always just a little bit of anger there. Like, you know, fuck that person for doing this to us, you know, because now they're done with their problems. Ours have just begun. Like, there is, like, and then there's also the follow on shame for feeling that way about it. I think that it would be real easy for Jimmy in the moment of his life in which Chuck chose to do this to wrap himself in a Mylar blanket of hashtag fuck Chuck and let Hamlin take all this emotional, or at least try. I don't think it'll be successful transference, but it'll be a perhaps successful appearing attempt for a few episodes.
Now, this is why that final scene is so good, because we don't really know.
There's
so many possibilities here of what's going on in Jimmy's head, and that's what we're going to be exploring.
So much of this plot is not taking place like right on. I mean, it's taking place right on camera, but they're not being explicit. Like, what is Jimmy thinking when he's whistling? What is Mike? Why is Mike doing this Madrigal electromotive? What does Gus think about Nacho in this situation?
These are all season premiere questions, you know, that we are going to get
answers to. They're not even being raised.
To.
It's just as you observe it, they're the things that pop in your head, which is a really confident style of storytelling. Reginald, Jimmy is very clearly being honest throughout this whole episode. He is panicking when he first hears about the accident and rushes to Chuck's house. He's crushed when he realizes his brother is dead. He is cynical when Kim tells him the firefighter said Chuck didn't suffer. He's nauseous when hearing of Chuck's many accomplishments listed in his obit. He is gracious to the well-wishers at the funeral, but most of all, he's relieved when he finds a sucker, Howard, to take away all of his negative feelings of guilt, remorse, etc. Also, he will be honestly heartbroken when Kim leaves him. He's not faking in any of these circumstances. However, Jimmy is a parasite, and he needs to feed off of others. He has no way of coping with the sadness of losing his brother, not drinking, not talking with Kim, other than letting Howard take the blame and twisting the knife in Howard's chest. Jimmy didn't have to confess what he did in order to throw Howard a lifeline by saying something like, "Hey man, don't beat yourself up over it. Who knows what's in another guy's head?" Nope, it's, well, that's your cross to bear. Those of us watching have got to come to grips with the fact that part of Jimmy / Saul, and maybe even Gene, enjoys the power of inflicting pain on others. I'm not mad at Jimmy for being so cold, slimy, and childish because I finally accepted him for what he really is. Harsh, but fair.
No, I mean, look at the scene in Breaking Bad where Saul helps Jesse get his parents' house, right?
Right.
Where he goes in and he strong-arms these two parents into selling their house for far less than it's worth. Mm-hmm. He's taking pleasure in that. He's enjoying every second of it.
Saul advocates Walt and Jesse murder their close associates to keep the crime from being pinned on them.
At some point, he figures out exactly who he is.
Yes.
And he rolls with it.
Yeah.
He leans into it. So this, I mean, it seems almost trite to say that this is an inflection point for Saul.
Sure.
For Jimmy as a human being. Mm-hmm. But I guess, like, it bears pointing out that this could be the very thing that we've been asking all along. What's the thing that's going to finally set Jimmy off, turn him into Saul? This is probably it.
Right. Maria from New York. The cabbie in the first episode looked a lot like an old Howard. What do you think about that? Do you agree, or was it some random cabbie?
Howard.
I don't.
Howard's let himself go to shit.
Sure, sure.
I don't buy for a second that Howard would allow that to happen to Howard Hamlin.
Maybe the knit ties were the only thing keeping his youth in check. Like, as soon as he switched to the fucking silk shit, it just went to hell. Just went to hell in a handbasket.
Right.
I don't know if I agree about
that. I don't
think
this is anybody. I don't think this is Jesse. I don't think this is Howard. Like, so many people are speculating on who this is.
It's just some
cabbie driver from Albuquerque who might recognize Saul.
I hope this cab driver doesn't be turned into fucking Snoke from, you know, the Last Jedi or whatever. Like, everybody's thinking, oh, maybe it's fucking Mace Windu. Maybe it's this, maybe it's that. Like,
I mean, it's already started.
I think it's Mace Windu. that lightning just really did a number on him. Bleached the skin right out. Brett, just listening to your instant take on Snoke. No, I'm sorry, Smoke. And I had a slightly different take on Jimmy's reaction to Howard's confession. Jimmy definitely had a light bulb go off when Howard mentioned the malpractice insurance. Isn't that Jimmy realizing he set in the motion when he told the insurance agent about his own brother last season? So I think we ended up covering this, Brett, but appreciate your feedback and bring that to our attention. Eric J., in the scene where Mike is rummaging through the garbage while he evaluates the security at Madrigal, there's a shot that clearly looks like a noose lined up with Mike. I have no idea what it's to symbolize, but the hanging rope looks so clearly like a noose and not like some wire or other kinds of set decorations you'd see for a warehouse. What do you guys think? We have both taken a look at this image. This is essentially right after Mike stands up from tossing the dumpster. And in the background, you almost have to lighten the background to see it, but there is what's very clearly a noose hanging over Mike's left shoulder, stage right.
Here's the thing. Normally, we would be speculating, oh, does this mean he's going to die in the next episode?
Right.
Well, we fucking know when Mike dies, and it's not because of a noose.
Right.
It's not because of anything even remotely like that. Mm-hmm. So what could this possibly be other than just a production thing? Like,
I mean,
it's back there. It's in the shot. Whatever.
I do think that this is like the Villa Gang to put something like that as a death motif to show that as Mike gets closer to this organization, he's getting closer to this ultimate fate.
This is the inflection point for Mike where he sealed his own fate.
The inflection point for Bald Move is when we started throwing around terms like fucking inflection point. I think, right, that, like, the Breaking Bad does a lot of stuff with the knowledge of, like, you know, they do stuff by accident. Like, you know, people went through Gale's apartment and, like, oh, my God, look at this. There's a statue. There's some stone statuary with half its face a different color. And some of it's by accident. Some of it is knowing where they're going. So they put stuff in, like, death motifs around Mike. Why not? But again,
I mean, the difference here being that
we're not foretelling the future by saying bad things are going to happen to Mike because we've seen them happen.
Right.
I mean, there are every time I mention that this is no one does this, people always come forward and say they do. I know for a fact there's people watching Better Call Saul that have never seen Breaking Bad. So surprise, might be surprised to them. Maybe the Villigan and Gould are making this so, like, when people in the future watch these shows as, like, a set, that this is, like, some kind of, like, cool thing. But, you know, it's just, could be a thing, could not be a thing. I'm pretty agnostic on this stuff at this point. But it is a cool detail to note. Paul D. from South Jersey. I really do like the Gene storyline and hope that they expand on it this year. I thought it'd be neat to bring some of what's going on with the White family to the story. Maybe Gene happens to be looking at the TV and sees an announcement that Walt Jr.'s received a huge sum of money. Wouldn't that be cool? I think it would be cool for Gene to somehow keep tabs on what's going on in Albuquerque and for us to get a few answers about, you know, like, maybe we'll get some hints to the fate of Jesse. Maybe we'll get some hints that Skyler and the kids are doing all right. Is there a you know, Baby Holly Foundation set up by the Schwartzes. I could see like a newspaper clipping or something like that.
Yeah, maybe. Something small. I don't want this to turn into a second finale for Breaking Bad, right? Like,
yeah.
I don't want this show to ultimately be about Breaking Bad.
Fan service is a dangerous thing because it's like cane sugar or high fructose corn sugar like syrup. It's addictive, it's cheap, it's easy to inject everywhere, but ultimately it's hollow and just makes you flabby and fat. So I think the show, when it first came out, was a little bit too heavy on the fan service, and now they've hit their stride. They got to be careful that they don't go back to that dark side again.
Yeah.
In the appropriate amount of doses, it would be cool to see Walton. It'd be cool in the Jimmy's timeline to see Walton, Jesse kind of prowling around in the back. It would be cool to see some Skyler and Walt Jr. Holly stuff in the Gene timeline if it's done in moderation and not forced. Ray sent us a fairly long and wide-ranging email discussion, but generally exploring her idea that everyone on the show is a con man of sorts. She did not accept Kim from that. She talked about Jimmy, Chuck. I think that's easy to see. She indicted the whole legal system. And her opinion, the most sincere person on the show is Howard Hamlin.
Yeah, I kind of think I agree with that.
So let's see. Her point of Jimmy. Jimmy is a con man. You don't have to explain.
Right. It's on the face.
Chuck was, as we previously discussed, running a con that he was healthier than he was just so he could exact revenge on the people that had wronged him or protect society from Jimmy.
Right.
Or unscrupulous law institutions like the one he founded. Mm-hmm. Kim.
Yeah.
Her point with Kim is that she's trying to be a bigger, more successful lawyer than she really is.
Which I think in some ways is true. I mean, she presents to Mesa Verde and to the oil company that she can handle all this work. No problem. She'll do it. And then she can't.
Right.
You know, that's a lie. That's a lie. She can't handle it all by herself. So in some ways, yes. But in other ways, I think Kim has a lot of the qualities that she professes to have.
Yeah.
That attention to detail, that stick-to-itness, that...
And to me, con involves knowing, like Kim would knowingly know that she would let these people down.
Sure,
I don't think
yeah.
Kim has ever run up at her limits. She's been working 80, 90-hour work weeks forever, and it's never caused her any problems. Now she micro-sleeped her way into a car crash, and literally her body and brain just said no more.
Yeah.
So to me, that's like Neil Armstrong saying, I'm going to be the first man that lands on the moon and his spaceship blows up. Like, he didn't I know Neil actually didn't do that, but if it had, he's like, he didn't con the American people, right?
Sure, no.
Better example, Jim Lovell, when he says, I'm going to go and land on the moon your father will be a guy to walk on the moon. He didn't con his kid and wife when he said that. He was just mistaken.
Yeah.
Now, Howard's interesting because, like, as she pointed out, there's hints that his life has not gone how he wanted. Like that, you know, when Jimmy was hanging out his own shingle and starting his shop, that, you know, he kind of admired that. It's like, that's kind of what I wanted to do. But, you know, I had this big firm and my dad insisted and blah, blah, blah. Like, he had these entanglements. The few times that he was kind of dissembling on the show, you find out it was because Chuck put him up to it.
Yeah, he was protecting Chuck.
It's going to be interesting to see the real Hamlin. And I think I've taken kind of a shine to Howard, the unwashed asshole, in the last few seasons because I see how he's been kind of a prisoner of his fate. And like the earlier returns, like it takes a lot of courage to go to this guy's brother and confess that you think you're complicit in his suicide.
Uh-huh.
I mean, that's a lot of opening yourself up. It's a lot of vulnerability. It's a lot of you know, emotional courage. Those things I admire in people. So it'll be interesting to see if Howard has some sort of dark side moment, absent like direct fuckery from Chuck or Jimmy.
Yeah.
What do you think? You think he will? I mean, we're talking about him and trying to embezzle his partner's money back and doing contract fraud and.
Or just doing what he rightfully has, what he has a legal right to do, right? If the check was never cashed, the paperwork was never signed, then it's not legally a thing. So maybe he doesn't have to dissemble and lie and cheat his way to that money. Maybe it's rightfully his by law.
There's what's moral, there's what's ethical, and there's what's legal, and they're not exactly overlapping sets.
That's true.
And I don't know how I feel about things that are legal but maybe not ethical. Maybe that's why I'm not a great businessman.
Yeah, I don't know. But I really think Howard and Kim are going to have to team up, tag team Jimmy, to figure out what the hell is wrong with him. And I don't even think they're going to be successful. I think, honestly, Jimmy is going to prevail and just become Saul and drive them both away, and that'll be his life.
So I understand why Kim would try to figure it. Why would Howard give a shit about figuring Jimmy out? Because you said they have to team up. I kind of agree, but I don't know what the motivation is from Howard's angle. If Kim comes three episodes from now, Kim goes to Howard for a favor and says, "I'm worried about Jimmy." Why doesn't Howard be like, "Well, that's your cross to bear. Mm-hmm. Out of my office.
You've stolen
my clients. You've blah blah. You blah blah blah. You let your boyfriend piss in my open mouth when I was on my knees begging for forgiveness." I don't know. I agree, but I don't see what brings them together.
Extra scene on the DVD.
Right. That's the new squat cobbler.
Yeah.
I don't know. It's the humbled Howard. it's getting peed into your open mouth while you're begging for forgiveness by emotional absolution. Finally, Sherry L., do you have any idea if the official Better Call Saul podcast will continue? I don't normally cheat on Bald Move, but their insights from that show were entertaining.
Oh, no, I cheat on Bald
Move.
You're in an open relationship.
Mm-hmm. We get it. You know, we can't give you everything that Vince and Peter
and
Jonathan Banks.
But neither can
Odin
they.
Kirk. So. Yeah. So, you know, you come to us for the cuddles and for the hardcore dickin', I guess you go to the Kelly Dixon, except why
here's,
is there? So let's,
here's
let's,
the controversy.
We should, for the people that are not on the inside, what? Why is there this concern about the official Better Call Saul podcast no longer happening?
So, the Better Call Saul Insider podcast, mm-hmm. Which is what it's called, if you want to check it out, and I suggest you do because it's good, was run by Kelly Dixon. She was kind of the impetus for that whole thing.
Who was
getting
the chief, like the senior
editor?
Of
Breaking Bad and also.
Right.
Here at Better Call Saul.
Right.
Does great work. She left the show this year.
Mm-hmm.
After season three, she's
and
gone.
This is kind of her passion project, like back in Breaking Bad. Like she did like one of the very first official podcasts for a show. She was very like, you know, Skunk Works type of project with and like that audio
started
quality.
Before we did.
Audio quality slowly began to improve.
Right.
Like,
the crosstalk slowly got better.
Yep, it's a little bit more focused.
But yeah, she left the show. So she kind of was in. She was in the process of training her protege, Skip McDonald, who's now the full-time editor on Better Cast Saul, or Better Call Saul, rather. And he was supposed to be taking over the podcast, I think. This is what I remember from listening to the finale episode a year and a half ago. I think he was supposed to take over the podcast. Yeah. So assuming Skip can both full-time edit a TV show and make a podcast, it will be coming back, I think.
Now, we'll say that like it hasn't updated yet.
Not yet.
And that usually was updated by the day after.
The day after. Sometimes it was like real close to when we released our podcast. So maybe a day or two.
Yeah.
So, especially with the new runner of the podcast.
Yeah. I mean, I'll give him, you know, like you said, it's someone learning the ropes. If they're going to continue it, I'd give him, you know, a little bit of extra time. But maybe things are looking bad if it's not dropping next week.
Yeah.
And that'd be a shame because, like, I know a lot of people complained about how rambly they could get and how, like, you know.
Self-congratulatory.
And I don't know about self-congratulatory because I also was about Vince and Peter trying to give everybody else credit.
But that's what I mean. Like, the show. Like,
right.
The group of people who make the show, they're always patting each other on the back. And
right.
It's like,
that the mouse's shadow is the second grip with the key light and he really got that thing. Yeah, I mean, like. That probably endears him to the production staff and crew, and it speaks well of what kind of showrunner he is, but not necessarily the most compelling stuff. But when they would get really deep about how like they'd use these new lenses and how much light they could capture and you know, like the onset, like, you know, what temperature it was, and Jonathan Banks was freezing his balls off, and you know, got his face sandblasted before this scene. Do you know that, like, we talked about that in Instant Podcast? Like, that's the only scene where that was a problem. The rest of them, he actually had, was it bad lighting? Did he just literally blow off the makeup lady that day? Or makeup gentleman?
I don't know. There were two outdoor scenes, one with him in the backyard with Kaylee. Right. And I didn't notice it in that scene.
Yeah,
so.
He looked like he'd had some foundation laid, or maybe his third-degree sunburns. He just wasn't used to Albuquerque.
Yeah, where's he live in the
off-season?
He's
got to live in L.A., right?
Probably.
Jonathan Banks, he's got to be prowling around L.A.
I assume so.
Giving free audits to Rodeo Drive establishments.
LA. Not known for not having sun.
Right. That's definitely true. That's definitely
so,
true.
So I don't know what's happening with his head, but he's still doing his thing.
Still doing his thing.
Yeah.
Well, hopefully he can recover from, I don't know, getting his head sanded and we'll be fine. It's like, you know, the other thing is like he had that cough of doom that like just, I guess he had a cold and they decided not to edit around it. Like, maybe, like, sometimes, like, does Jonathan Banks come sometimes come in and he's, like, slightly on fire? He's, like, there's smoke coming off of him.
Right.
Like, you know, like, he's got piranha bites on him. And the people just don't ask questions. It's just JB, get him in his chair, get him in costume, get him on the set so he can do his thing.
You can find him on the weekends on a pier in Long Beach just blowing fire. He's a fire swallower.
Yeah.
Yeah, fire blower.
Yeah.
Sometimes it goes wrong.
Yeah, it can. Sometimes he's not actually bald.
No.
It's just
his job keeps him bald.
He's engulfed in flames 50% of the time. all right, thanks for everybody sending in feedback. Reminder, on Monday nights, right after the show airs at 9 p.m. Eastern Standard, we do a Instant Talk podcast. If you are on the Eastern time zone, or if you've got a way to watch it through satellite or whatnot, please feel free to join up. If you're a club member, go to the article on baldmove.com. There'll be a live Instant Talk article. Click through that. You can watch the video. There'll also be a link to participate in the chat. Mm-hmm. And after we say our piece for 15-20 minutes, we will then turn and answer your guys' questions and consider your comments. It's a nice way to get some early feedback and just kind of extend that nice little afterglow you get from watching your favorite television show. For club members. And if you're not a club member, you can join at club.baldmove.com. Feedback goes to bettercastsaul@baldmove.com or forums.baldmove.com if you would like to talk with your fellow friends. We'll be back next week for the next episode. Until then, I'm Aaron.
And I'm Jim.
Later.